Chapter 14. The Party Line. Fancy Dress and April Fools. There was once a popular saying that everybody loves a good party, and it may still be true, but there just don't seem to be nearly as many of them as there used to be. Or perhaps I'm just not getting invited like I used to be. Everything that's really worthwhile in life usually involves some degree of risk, and in all we do at Virgin, we have always revelled in taking on the seemingly impossible, rather than shying away and playing it safe. This applies as much to having a good time as to business, and we have never had any qualms about kicking back and enjoying a fun party with our people. I have always believed that the benefits of letting your staff have the occasional blast at an after-hours get-together is a hugely important ingredient in the mix that makes for a family atmosphere and a fun-loving, free-spirited corporate culture. It also goes a long way to tearing down any semblance of hierarchy when you've seen the CFO doing the limbo with a bottle of beer in her hand. From the very beginning, the Virgin companies have grown up on the back of some of the biggest and heartiest parties known to almost civilized man. For years, our annual summer staff parties at the Manor, our former recording studio in the Oxfordshire countryside, were the stuff of local legend. They started out on a fairly controlled basis, with a single day's get-together for all the Virgin UK staff and their families. We'd set up big tents in case it rained, which it seldom ever seemed to do, and had loads of food and drink, live bands, face painters, bouncy castles and pony rides for the kids, and a few adult children, and a great time was always had by all. One of the highlights of the event for everyone, except possibly me, became my annual version of a tightrope walk. This involved me, often with a drink in both hands to help my stability, at least that's my story, gingerly wobbling my way across about the 75-foot ridge atop the biggest marquee, with the assembled crowd loudly cheering me on, or more probably off. I honestly have no recollection as to how this custom got started, which probably explains it, but I think it was either the tent owners, my life insurance company, or sobriety that eventually brought the practice to an end. As the business started to grow by leaps and bounds, when Virgin Atlantic arrived on the scene, we probably doubled our group headcount within 12 months, it began to make the big annual bash a logistical and practical challenge. In the final analysis, the mega parties were killed by their success, as they simply grew too big to handle. The last one was over a whole weekend, and we, and the local police who were charged with handling the traffic jams, estimated something like 60,000 people showed up. This included a lot of spouses and children of employees, which was never the case in the earlier days when most people were single with no inhibitions about having a wild time, something far less likely to happen in front of spouses and kids. Airplay. If the Manor parties could have made it into the Guinness Book of World Records, so too could the 1984 inaugural flight of Virgin Atlantic. Not because of any particular aviation achievement, but rather for the greatest amount of champagne ever consumed in a single flight between London and New York. Not since Wilbur and Orville kicked the whole thing off can anyone have come close. It was one huge transatlantic party from the moment the seatbelt sign went off until it came on again for landing in Newark. The late TV personality and journalist David Frost, who was one of our celebrity guests on the trip, was renowned for commuting across the Atlantic almost every other day. Just before landing, I remember him saying to me, "You know, Richard, I've probably flown across the pond 1,000 times, but that's the first trip I've ever made standing up all the way with a drink in my hand." The other little-known fact about that inaugural flight into New York is that the very first passenger that Virgin Atlantic landed in the USA was an illegal immigrant. When the aircraft door opened at Newark, we were met by a bevy of local officials at the end of the jetway, all of whom, I suspect, were more than a little curious to see what this rock and roll airline actually looked like. There had been stories all week on New York City radio stations about how Boy George would be flying the airplane, that we would likely be met by drug-sniffing dogs and all sorts of nonsense. While the cabin crew were doing their document handover, I was anxiously looking for David Tate, who ran our U.S. operation, hoping that, as planned, he'd managed to beat us across the Atlantic that morning on Concorde. When I finally spied him and caught his eye, I very deliberately mouthed the words, "I don't have my passport." Knowing my penchant for pulling pranks on people, David laughed out loud and shouted back, "Yeah, right! Of course you don't, Richard! Nice try, though!" The unfortunate thing was that it was true. In the desperate rush to get to Gatwick Airport that morning, I had dashed out, leaving my passport on the kitchen counter. When the in-flight supervisor laughingly told David it was actually true, he believed her, but not me, he managed to quickly square it away with the head of immigration, who fortunately happened to be standing right there. I remember thinking how incredibly impressed these senior federal officials must have been when the chairman of the new airline has to beg to be allowed into the country without any documents. Things didn't get much better for me in the next hour when, at the welcome reception the city threw for us at the airport, I mistook the mayor of Newark for one of the caterers and asked him if there was any chance they could find some more shrimp. Oh well, I suppose we all have our off days. Our three airlines, Virgin Atlantic, Virgin America, and Virgin Australia, still turn almost every new route launch into an excuse for a party, or three, and all of the companies in the group still love to party at every possible opportunity. The days of the mega parties at the Manor may be a thing of the past, but generally we have reverted to the original, smaller, more intimate routes, and settings in which everyone gets a chance to glimpse an other side to the people they work with, including myself, whenever I can work an invitation. Rocking the Rock. In January 2012, Virgin Money finally acquired Northern Rock, the British high street bank that had been nationalized 4 years earlier, and we had a lot to celebrate. After their brief spell of working for the government, Northern Rock's 2,000 or so employees were clearly excited about joining the Virgin family. They didn't have to wait long to get a taste of their new corporate culture when Jane Ann Gardia, CEO of Virgin Money, and I hosted a huge street party inside Northern Rock's headquarters in Newcastle-upon-Tyne, at which everyone got an opportunity to behave in very unbanker-like ways. It was kind of an initiation by friendly fire for all the former Northern Rock people, who I don't think had ever seen their previous bosses loosen their ties, let alone their purse strings, for a bank-sponsored mega-bash. By the end of the night, I must have shaken 1,000 hands and my fingers were literally numb from the process. Jane Ann and I posed for scores of group photographs, and the bank's staff even got to rub shoulders with some true local heroes in the form of several Newcastle United football stars who we'd invited to join in the festivities. Virgin Money had just agreed to be a kit sponsor for the Magpies, Newcastle's Premiership pride and joy, and it would seem the energy from the party must have rubbed off on the players. A couple of days later, in front of a packed home crowd, while wearing their new Virgin Money logo shirts for the first time, they managed to pull off a spectacular 3-0 upset victory over champions Manchester United, all very much to Jane Ann's confusion, as she is a lifelong Manchester United fan. So you see, there's nothing like a good party to get everyone's juices flowing. though I must confess that being conscious of the fact that several of our businesses, Northern Rock, now Virgin Money included, do a huge amount of business in Manchester as well, I thought it only prudent to tweet, OK, I accept, we're jammy bastards. Anyway, all in all, we got off to a memorable start with our new banker friends, and it has kept on getting better ever since. We had another great party not so long ago to celebrate the opening of the Virgin Group's new corporate headquarters in London. We held it on the rooftop of the new building. It was a fancy dress affair with everyone coming dressed as pirates and buccaneers. We had flaming torches and a Caribbean steel band, plus lots of red stripe beer and rum-based cocktails. I showed up with Joan and my two kids, who also brought their new spouses along to make it truly a family affair. At one point in the festivities, surrounded by hundreds of dancing Virgin staff, I looked down from our rooftop perch and realized that behind a clump of trees, I could just about see the houseboat that was my home and office when we started the company over 40 years earlier. When we had staff parties on the Duende, which I still own, we maxed out at only 20 or 30 people, but the bonhomie we generated was no different to the present day, with 10 times that number on the roof of an office tower. As silly as dressing up as Captain Morgan the pirate or walking along the top of a tent might sound, I have always believed that parties have been an essential part of the Virgin Way, and political correctness be damned, I wouldn't have it any other way. What's first, a happy chicken or a happy egg? For most people, the assumption seems to be that the more money you have in the bank, the happier you'll be. That success has some straight-line correlation with happiness. If I work harder, I'll be more successful, and if I'm more successful, I'll be happier. While nobody is likely to argue that being penniless might not detract from one's joie de vivre, according to recent research, happiness actually fuels success, not the other way around. Sean Acor's fascinating book, The Happiness Advantage, is based on a decade of positive psychology and neuroscience research at Harvard University and Fortune 500 companies. His book reveals that when we are more positive, our brains are more engaged, more energized, creative, motivated, healthier, resilient, and productive. A pretty compelling list. His conclusion is that 90% of one's happiness is generated from within, not by external factors like fat bank accounts and expensive possessions. The book cites the power of positivity in the present and how we can rewire our brains in as little as 21 days by way of things such as starting each day with a random act of kindness, like sending at least one email praising someone, or writing down three new things each day for which we are grateful. Such actions get one's dopamine flowing, which, in simple terms, makes you feel better about yourself. And, well, the better you feel, the better you perform. So, having fun and enjoying the work experience at every turn is not just the Virgin Way, but it is also scientifically proven to work to everyone's benefit. I just wish I'd read Sean's book 40 years ago, as it would have greatly helped in my annual attempts to vindicate the excessive party bills with a succession of tightwad CFOs around the group. April, come she will. While staff parties are all about having a big get-together and lots of collective fun as often as possible, I have to admit to also taking a somewhat different and more selfish delight in having a devilishly good time just once a year on April Fool's Day. In fact, anyone who knows me well will usually make their best efforts to stay well clear of me between midnight and noon on the 1st of April, which, in case you weren't aware of the official fool rules, are the hours between which any tricks have to be played out. So if anyone ever tries to pull a stunt on you after noon, you should call them out for foul play. When I was a boy, I used to pull all the usual April Fool's pranks on my parents and sisters, like tying bedroom doorknobs together across a hallway so neither occupant could open their doors. Unlike a lot of kids who quickly grow out of April Fool's tricks, however, quite the opposite happened with me. Ever the contrarian, in my case, the older I got, the more demonic and elaborate my tricks became. In time, they also became a fun annual vehicle for me to draw attention to the Virgin brand, sometimes with the most amazing results. For example, in 1986, I decided it would be fun to put one over on the music industry. So we hatched a fiendish plot, and on the 31st of March, I gave an exclusive interview to Music Week, then the UK's biggest music industry trade publication. I told them that for years, Virgin had been secretly developing a giant computer on which we had stored every music track we could lay our hands on. This revolutionary device would be called Music Box, and music lovers would be able to use it as a source from which, for a small fee, they could download any individual song or album they wanted. Much to my surprise and delight, they swallowed it hook, line and sinker, and so the following day, in their April the 1st edition, the shocking headline blared, "Branson's Bombshell, the End of the Industry." Surprisingly oblivious to the 1st of April dateline on the article, all kinds of music business senior executives called throughout the morning to beg, threaten, and plead with me not to go ahead with such a crazy scheme. With all of them, I just kind of muttered half apologies, saying I would make another statement later in the day, which, of course, came at lunchtime, when I announced that the whole story had been an April Fool's joke. That afternoon, I got a lot more calls from music industry types with comments that I am afraid I will not be able to repeat. It was many years later, when I ran into Steve Jobs at some event or other, that he told me that he too had read the bogus Music Box story and been utterly taken in by it. At the time, he had just been edged out of Apple and founded Next, but he said he'd never forgotten my spoof, and at the time thought that, joke or no joke, there was definitely something to be said for our Music Box idea. So, while we will never know for sure, since that chance conversation, I have always been haunted with the thought that my April Fool's idea might well have inadvertently helped trigger the birth of iTunes and the iPod, which, ironically, were to become the death knell for our Virgin megastores, and a game-changer for the music industry in general. Clearly, the moral behind this story is that if you're going to let others know, even as an April Fool's joke, how you think your industry might look in the future, then you had better make sure that your company has a plan already in place to get you there first. If you don't, then the joke could very easily be on you. One bad trick deserves another. There was another April stunt that most definitely did backfire on me, even if a lot more of our people got a big kick out of it. I had decided to pull an April Fool's trick on Ken Berry, one of my early partners in Virgin Records. On the 31st of March, I invited Ken and his girlfriend to a late dinner at the Roof Gardens, the rooftop restaurant and club we own in the Kensington area of London. The plan was all set for some hired hands to go and break into Ken's apartment a few minutes after midnight, I play by the rules, and remove a bunch of things like some furniture, his TV and stereo equipment. We had some actors dressed up as policemen who were going to come in to ask questions and dust for fingerprints, and eventually I'd yell, "April Fool!" We'd all have a good laugh, bring the stuff back, and it would be over. At least, That was the plan. But as Robert Burns pointed out, the best-laid schemes of mice and men gang after glay, and this one was about to go as aglay as it gets. The problem started when, after I got tied up talking to someone else, I got back to our table about 15 minutes after midnight to find that Ken and friend had left for home, leaving a note saying, "Thanks for dinner. See you tomorrow. Ken." I panicked because I knew they'd be home already, and as such it was already too late for me to get there to stage-manage the prank. Not knowing what to do, I headed for home and was greeted by my wife Joan, who wasn't in on the joke because she would have totally disapproved of it, saying, "Richard, something awful has happened. Kenny's flat's been broken into and the police are there now. He called to ask if his girlfriend could spend the night with us as she's too scared to stay in the flat." So I had no alternative but to call Ken and come clean, apologize profusely, and arrange for all his stuff to be returned straight away. His reaction was one of, "Well, Richard, I don't really know if I can do anything because the police have filed the report already. But leave it with me and I'll try to explain it to them." Feeling more than a little embarrassed at the whole screw-up, I was about to head for bed when the doorbell rang. Sensing this wasn't good, I opened the door to find two very large London bobbies who seemed anything but amused at my antics, and gruffly asked if I would accompany them to the station to assist them with their inquiries. I was dressed for bed, but they didn't seem to care, and hauled me off still in dressing gown and slippers. In the car they said nothing in response to my repeated whines of, "This is all a terrible mistake," and "Please just call Mr. Berry. He can explain that there was no robbery here." They remained inscrutable as they marched me into Harrow Road Police Station, took away my dressing gown cord, presumably so I wouldn't hang myself, shoved me into a cell, and departed without saying another word. It only got worse. A half hour later, I was awoken from a fitful sleep by screams from the unseen occupant of the cell next to mine. It sounded like a beating was underway as I heard, "Please don't hit me again! Honest, Guff, I didn't do nothing!" It stopped soon after, and I lay there the rest of the night feeling more than a little contrite and extremely sorry for myself. Finally, around midday, the same two policemen arrived at the cell and, without saying a word, took me upstairs, where they charged me with a dozen or more offences, including wasting police time. They then handed me my dressing gown cord and told me I was free to leave. I still wasn't too sure what had happened, but as soon as I stepped out into the grey morning light, the penny dropped with a resounding cheer. The cheer came from the assembled Virgin Records staff, led by Kenny and the policeman, standing outside the police station as they celebrated my release with my familiar cry of "April Fool!" I'd been set up, big time. If ever a joke backfired on me, this had to be it. I later found that when Ken had told the police that the burglary was all a joke gone wrong by a friend of his, the officers in charge were not in the least amused. They at first wanted to charge me with either criminal mischief as well as wasting police time, but at Ken's pleading, that's his story at least, instead agreed they'd drop it on one condition, that Ken would support them in teaching his wayward friend a lesson that he won't soon forget, by keeping him locked up in a cell until noon, when April Fool's Day officially ended. Needless to say, Ken had agreed immediately, in all probability thinking it was an absolutely wonderful idea. And as for the whole beating thing in the next cell, that too had been staged by some of our people. To infamy and beyond. I suppose after such a lesson, most, dare I say, normal people would have been traumatized at the mere mention of April Fool's tricks forevermore. Unfortunately, that is not how my brain is wired. If anything, I simply became more determined than ever to make a better job of future stunts, like the one we almost pulled off on the 1st of April 1989. At the time, I was 36 years old and very much into ballooning, which is what inspired me to come up with the idea for what is arguably my most elaborate April Fool's stunt ever. I commissioned the creation of a custom-designed hot-air flying saucer from my friend Don Cameron at Cameron Balloons, and to my delight, he came through with what was really a quite remarkable piece of equipment. Shaped like a classic comic book flying saucer, our UFO came complete with rotating flashing strobe lights, which by night offset the eerie glow that was produced every time the hot air burner was fired. The icing on the cake, though, had to be the little person, I'm told I'm not allowed to say dwarf, we hired to go along on the trip wearing a custom-tailored little green Martian costume. Not to be outdone, I joined in the fun with a Captain Kirk-like sparkly silver spacesuit. So, while I played Captain Kirk, Don Cameron, one of the world's top balloonists, came along to co-pilot his company's brilliant handiwork. We took off from North London at around 4 in the morning, flew over the city, and then found ourselves, with balloons you go where the prevailing winds choose to take you, heading down the M25 in the general direction of Gatwick Airport. For the three of us in the air, it was all plain sailing. What we didn't know about, however, was the havoc we were creating 500 feet below us back on planet Earth. Apparently, we were spotted by some night shift workers early in our flight, and the UFO sighting they called into their local police station had set a War of the Worlds repeat performance in motion. As radio stations excitedly speculated on the origins of the low-flying alien craft, with every mile we flew, the furore on the ground grew crazier by the minute. Before long, there were three police forces tracking us, and the army had been called out too. The busy M25 motorway, already slowed by a heavy morning fog, was now at a standstill as motorists stopped and got out of their cars to marvel at the mysterious UFO as it flew over them in the pre-dawn gloom. By this stage, we were getting a little too close to Gatwick Airport, London's second busiest, for our liking, and so decided it was time to call it quits. Despite the fog, we managed to spot a level field, and with strobe lights flashing and the burners glowing mysteriously in the gloom, Don brought us down without incident, or so we thought. Looking out of my little window in the space capsule, I remember thinking that this was like an eerie scene from a Steven Spielberg movie, and it was right about then that I spied a line of police vehicles and army trucks surrounding the field. When Don landed us perfectly without a bump, a brave young Bobby, truncheon drawn, started walking none too confidently in our direction. It was E.T. time. We started our own fog machine before slowly lowering the ramp-like door and dispatching our little green E.T. to meet him. Without a second thought, the terrified policeman turned on his heels and ran as fast as I've ever seen anyone move. It was at this stage that I decided I'd better intercede before someone got hurt, so jumping onto planet Earth, I welcomed its brave defenders with the universal peace declaration of April Fool! The first reaction from the fleeing officer was one of utter relief, but according to a report on the website Alien UFO Sightings, the policeman involved would later tell the press, "I have never been so scared in 20 years on the force." His senior officers were not at all amused, however, and for the second time in my April Fool's career, I was threatened with charges of wasting police time, but survived to fight again. Needless to say, I am not the only one who has indulged in some pretty wild April Fool's stunts. Two of the better ones I heard about were perpetrated upon Eric Schmidt when he was at Sun Microsystems. One time, his friendly staff took apart his office and rebuilt it on a platform in the middle of a pond, complete with working telephone, which I thought a really nice touch. Another time, they emptied out his office and replaced the furniture with a Volkswagen Beetle, which they'd taken apart and reassembled in order to get it through the office door. Eric's subsequent employers at Google are also renowned for their own stunts, such as Google Nose. On the 1st of April, when pulling up the Google homepage, visitors found a new tab that professed it would let them smell various things. Strangely, these included a wet dog, by putting their noses up close to the screen. No one I know would ever admit to being fooled by this prank, but one can only imagine the gullible millions who must have sniffed their screens that morning. One of the all-time April classics, however, has to be Google TISP, Toilet Internet Service Provider, which on the 1st of April 2007 was featured on the Google search homepage as a fully functional end-to-end system that provides free in-home wireless access by connecting your Commode-based TISP wireless router to one of thousands of TISP access nodes via fiber-optic cable strung through your local municipal sewage lines. Google boasted that TISP used G-Flush technology, and it came with an 8-step installation kit for the quick, easy, and largely sanitary process. Item number 8 read, "Congratulations, you're online. Please wash your hands before surfing." Considering that in 2007, Google averaged 1.2 billion searches per day, in 2013 that number was up to 5.9, there's little doubt that TISP qualifies as the most viewed April Fool's stunt in history. Absolutely brilliant stuff. And then there was the joint Virgin and Google, or Virgle, as we dubbed it, April Fool's stunt that Larry Page and I dreamed up at the bar on Necker. But let's save that for another day. Fun is infectious. As you may have started to appreciate, like Google, Virgin takes the business of fun very seriously. I know that many unhappy souls will inevitably condemn stunts like these as being needless distractions and a waste of company time and effort with no tangible commercial benefits. How sad. If the workplace, where most adults spend almost half their waking weeks, cannot be an environment in which to enjoy some spontaneous good times, then what's the point of it all? I have always believed that a sense of humor and the ability not to take oneself too seriously are critically important attributes for any healthy corporate culture. One highly tangible upside is seeing how much of a buzz our staff get from talking about the crazy stuff we do at Virgin with friends. When those friends work at stuffed shirt companies that would never in a million years consider such nutty antics, you just know that they're thinking, "Wow, how do I get a job there?" I don't think it any coincidence that, like Google, we are snowed under with thousands of applications every time we have job openings or start a new company. Fun is infectious, and as Sean Acor's research can testify, it's also good for the general well-being of the individual and their businesses. It has certainly worked for Virgin and Google. Oh, and just in case you were wondering, as many did at the time we first broke the news, I should make it absolutely clear that Virgin Galactic is very much for real. If you care to check, you will see the first announcement in 2004 was not made on the 1st of April. If you want to see one great company party, however, then you should watch out for the celebration we have in mind when Spaceship Two completes its first commercial flight. It has been a long time coming, but I can assure you it will be one heck of a bash that will have been well worth the wait. And for those of us on board that first galactic flight, rather like the first transatlantic Virgin Atlantic flight some 30 years earlier, I am sure we will have to run some serious experiments on how well champagne sprays in a weightless environment. Strictly for scientific purposes, of course. Cheers.